All right. Well, this is working, and it worked well yesterday, so we're good. Good. I also want to be mindful of time. You've got to be finished by 1, I'm guessing, for your class.
Pretty close to 1. I mean, you know, there's an hour's leeway in there, you know.
Okay.
So, you know, if the shit totally hits the fan, it's okay.
Okay. All right. I kind of wanted to start maybe with a broader set of questions and then
sure.
come back more specifically to you.
I have one piece of paper here for you.
Okay.
Yes, I do. Okay. I'm all set.
Okay. So I thought maybe we could talk more generally about how your work relates to nanotechnology. And I guess maybe we'd start with the question of, do you think of yourself as a nanotechnologist?
Not really. I don't. I mean, 98% of people working in nanotech mm-hmm. Are working either with nanoparticles or carbon nanotubes or buckyballs or whatever. And I'm not. I mean, I use those things because there seems to be some interest mm-hmm. in being able to organize them. But my thing is using the architectural properties, as we talked about yesterday, using the architectural properties of DNA to organize either it or other stuff.
Okay.
Okay, so the other, you know, it's most people are interested in the other stuff. I mean, I get the table of contents of Nano Letters and ACS Nano. I'm on both those boards. Online on a weekly basis, and you know, I look through there, and you know, they're perfect journals for me because there's rarely more than one article in each issue uh-huh. out of maybe 50 that's actually of any importance to me, and the others I can ignore.
Okay,
that's also true of JAX.
JAX is the Journal of American Chemical Society.
Yeah, okay. I mean, so I mean, for me, a perfect journal is a journal where I only have to really worry about one article in it, and I can forget about the other 50. Mm-hmm. If I have to worry about all 50 of them, then I'm going a little bit too low on the food chain.
Okay.
Because, you know, you can't deal with 50 articles. You can deal with one.
With one. Okay. So you don't think of yourself as a nanotechnologist, yet you're doing structural DNA nanotechnology.
Yeah. I mean, that's the word we're using.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people always want to put a label on you.
Okay.
But, I mean, I'm doing what I'm doing. I mean, it's, you know, whatever it is that kind of strikes my fancy and uh-huh. which keeps the funding agencies happy.
Okay.
That's, you know, as long as they're happy and I'm happy, I don't have any mm-hmm. Any need to put myself in this bucket or that bucket or that bucket. My poor late mother, you know, was continually confused because I kept bouncing, you know, my label kept mm-hmm. changing. She'd say, "Oh, you're a biochemist." Well, not exactly. Well, I'm closer to a crystallographer.
Mm-hmm.
"Oh, so you're a crystallographer." Well, I'm actually these days closer to a biophysicist.
Yeah.
"Oh, so you're a biophysicist." Well, actually, people are telling me that what I do is nanotech, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've seen that line because I've published it enough times, you know, that my response to being told I was doing nanotech was the same as Monsieur Jourdain, right?
Yeah.
"Oh, I speak prose. How wonderful," right?
Yeah, yeah.
"I do nanotech. How wonderful."
Okay.
But in fact, you know, I do what I do, and other people tell me what they call it.
So do you think that's typical for a lot of people in your
know.
Field?
I mean, what's my field is, you know, kind of, you know, what Ned does. Right?
Okay.
I think others are, you know, most people are more, more tightly bucketed. They want to be more tightly bucketed.
Yeah.
Because everybody, you know, in this business tends to get, you know, tends to rise or fall with, you know, to some extent, with the popularity of the field, the area, the discipline, whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
And so, you know, you want to have a home. Everybody wants to have a home.
Sure.
By which I mean scientifically, intellectual slash scientific home.
Right.
Because that way you'll run into people, and you can. You know, who do the same thing, do related things.
Mm-hmm.
A, you can collaborate. B, you can band together, and you know, reap the rewards of such combinations. That's one of the reasons that I was involved in the founding of this ISNSC.
I have a set of questions. Yeah. I'll come back to that.
Okay.
But before we get to that, I wanted to also you touched a little bit on Drexler yesterday and Foresight, and I know you received a prize from them in '95.
Right.
But I kind of wanted to get your assessment of what you think maybe Drexler or Foresight did for Nano that was both positive or negative?
Well, I think that you know, on the positive side, the word certainly exists.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
Which is more than, let me just get this thing, it's going to keep beeping for a long time.
Okay.
ceaselessly. So the word is in front of the public. If I say to somebody, I do nanotech, you know, they kind of know what that is, mm-hmm. Or at least they've heard the word. Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent you can credit foresight with that.
Okay.
The negative side is that, you know, to get anything to actually be accepted is very hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, any new endeavor, you know, damn near any paper. I mean, my papers are still rejected at an enormous rate, often by the editors themselves, sometimes the referees don't like it, whatever. Mm-hmm. Since I won this damn Kavli Prize, the rejection rate has really gone up.
Okay.
Okay? Because yeah. I'm a better target now.
Uh-huh.
You know, everybody's resentful of everybody else to some extent.
So they're holding you to a higher standard?
No, I mean, these were editors. I mean, these weren't reviewers.
Huh.
I mean, I sent off three papers to three Baby Natures. I'm sure they hate being called Baby Natures. within about a month or so of winning the award before I even left to Norway, all three of them were bounced editorially. I mean, you know, no review.
Do they give a reason for why?
They always give the same bullshit reason. For our broad readership, this is too specialized. You know, so like, we made the first crystals of DNA origami, and some dickhead editor at Nature Nanotech used exactly that line. Mm-hmm. This is for a more specialized audience.
Hmm.
I mean, this guy happens to be a putz.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's as simple as that. And he's, I don't know what his problem is, but he's a jerk off.
Okay.
And I don't send him Nature Nanotech anymore because of him. Because it's, I mean, the first time he did, I got a paper in there through him. I mean, he delayed it so I had a later publication year. And the second time, I mean, he went off for Christmas. Fuck you very much, you know? I wrote this paper back in October. All you're doing is jerking around. I mean, they publish about, you know, five papers a week or something. Or an issue. It's not a week, it's, you know.
Yeah.
Larger. And, you know, and then in fact, Big Nature, when I wound up publishing it in Angevin, and Big Nature actually had, you know, as one of their, you know, things that happened this week, they had, you know, a short paragraph about this paper that Nature Nanotech wouldn't consider.
Okay. So thinking back to Foresight, did you go to a lot of conferences? You mean,
I don't go to conferences. Unless I'm invited. I mean, the exception to that used to be the Biophysical Society, because there were people there. I told this to somebody. Maybe it probably may not have been you. There were people there that I felt I should see, sort of once a year. They kept me honest. They were serious biophysicists. I mean, here I am flying all over, you know, doing stuff that some people say is, you know, is a little on the light side or whatever. And, you know, these people kept me honest, I felt.
Okay.
But they started getting old and retiring or changing their interests. So, you know, so I didn't no longer saw them in biophysics. I didn't see them there. So the standard, you know, the scheduled meetings that I attend that are not, sort of invitation only meetings or invitation to speakers and, you know, applications. Yeah.
So the Foresight meetings in the 90s were by invitation?
You know. No, they weren't. But, but what I'm saying is I don't attend such meetings unless I'm invited. I don't go to a meeting to sit at somebody else's feet.
Okay.
Okay, and listen to their words of wisdom. And that's been my policy for a very long time.
Okay.
At least 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only standard meetings I go to are the two that are sponsored by ISNSCE, because that group has kind of become my community.
Okay.
And, you know, one group probably a little more than the other group, but I go to both meetings.
Okay, before we talk about
the third meeting is, there's a nucleic acid physical chemistry meeting in Albany that I was involved with. It's run by a friend of mine from my Albanian period, and it's cheap for me to take my entire group there it's an every other year meeting.
Okay.
So I can have, and I believe my group should, you know, experience a meeting every couple of years.
Yeah. So that's one of the few things that will get you back to Albany.
Yeah, that's yeah. I mean, you know, I'll go anywhere for invitations, as long as you know, as long as I can escape, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, I hated, you know, the people in Pittsburgh were very nice to me, but I really didn't like the town very much.
Okay.
In that era, in the late 60s.
Yeah.
And you know, but if I go back to Pittsburgh, you know, I see my friends, such as they're still around, and you know, I have a good time. I mean, it's the indefinite sentence that gets you, particularly in Albany, where it was really an indefinite sentence.
I want to also ask you some questions about the National Nanotech Initiative. I mean, we talked about that a little bit yesterday, and you referenced Clinton's speech, but I kind of wanted to get your sense of your own perspective on how and why it came about, and
I have no idea why it came about. You know, there are movers and shakers in the nanotech area. I'm not one of them.
Okay.
Okay. You know, relative to the government. I mean, you know, I've run into people from various companies or government people say, "Oh yes, well at this White House meeting, da-dump, da-dump, da-dump." Well, you know, nobody invited me to that meeting. I don't know shit about it.
Okay.
All right. And that's sort of where I've been for a very long time. That I've you know, partly because I'm not at an elite institution, or in the private sector equivalent thereof, or whatever, or connected, and I remember the National Academy. You know, nobody includes me in any of these kind of deliberations.
Okay.
So.
But as an outsider, just sort of seeing
as
how
an outsider, I thought it was very poorly organized.
Because
what you know, they had basically two kind of group grants. They had these NERTs, which are about a four-person grant, or the money for four people at any rate. And then they had these NSECs. Well, NSEC, you know, I was totally out of competition for an NSEC. I mean, I look at funding opportunities very, you know, chauvinistically. You know, can I get my piece of that action or not?
Yeah.
So I was eligible for a NERT. And I was not eligible for an NSEC because you couldn't put together an NSEC in a place like NYU. I mean, Columbia got one. You know, other schools of that caliber got one. We're not that caliber.
Okay.
And I to be frank, I felt that class difference in university between the elite institutions. You know, your Ivies, your super schools in the in the Middle West and the West. Very strongly my entire career, and it was very evident when I was a postdoc that you know things happened for people at MIT, which was obviously such an institution, that didn't happen for people at middle level institutions.
It's just funny for me to hear you say that because for history NYU is considered an elite institution.
Yeah, so. but for the sciences it's not. It's mediocre. It's probably getting better. I mean certainly the physicists are better than they were when I got here 20 years ago. Chemistry may or may not be better. You know, it's very hard to judge rankings of institutions.
Yeah, I know the National Academy does these rankings every so often, but they seem to be...
I don't know if it's the National Academy or so.
Or the NRC.
The NRC,
yeah.
Or something does these rankings.
Yeah.
You know, we've never ranked above 50, I think, in chemistry. In fact, we were in the 70s for most of the time I've been here.
Okay.
And, you know, it's not so much whether you're in anywhere between, you know, 70, you know, 100 and say 20, 25, you know, it's not the same as being in, you know, between 25 and 1.
Okay.
There are elite monies that are occasionally, at least used to be available to the top schools, and people aren't listened to. I mean, there are a fair number of German postdocs. Who have visited this laboratory? At least two I can think of, and maybe a Canadian and whatever. Yeah, and they come here and they learn stuff and whatever, and they go back and they finish their degrees. You know, and I say to them, you know, so what are you doing for a postdoc? And they say, well, I'm going to apply for a DFG or whatever the Canadian equivalent is.
Yeah.
And you know, Ned, you're a really great guy. You do really great stuff. And William Shea is at Harvard.
Okay.
So guess what?
They go to Harvard.
And you know something? I did that too when I was a postdoc. I mean, I went to MIT. I went to,
right.
I didn't realize how crappy Columbia was, but
yeah.
I mean, I went to the elite because the next step after being at an elite institution is a professorship, and you know, you want to come out of a dump. You know, nobody's going to take you seriously.
Okay.
No matter how good your science seems to be.
Okay. Why don't we talk a little bit about the International Society for Nanoscale Science, Computation, and Engineering.
Yeah, all right. So that was put together from the direction of, actually, of, so that there are two meetings that take place under his auspices. There's the DNA X, I think we're about
so
to
So we
know.
Just had DNA 17 at
We just had 17 and 18 is going to be in Aarhus.
Oh, okay.
And so that meeting goes North America, Europe, North America, Asia, and repeat.
Okay.
Okay. So two-thirds of them are in north or in the Western Hemisphere, and one-third, you know, a quarter each in Asia and in Europe. And that was put together originally. I mean, I wrote a sort of document to get it off the ground because there have been discussions at DNA 7.
Roughly when is this happening?
2001.
2001. Okay, yeah. So this is a fairly recent group then.
Well, yeah, I mean, we just had 18, right?
Yeah.
And the F-Nano meetings are more that's the other group.
Yeah.
And those are more recent. They began in the last decade.
What's the F stand for?
Foundations of Nanoscience.
Okay.
And, you know, they both have their strengths and weaknesses. DNA-1 was a meeting on DNA... based computation that took place at Princeton, and it was my program director at the Navy, so I was 95, my program director at the Navy said, Ned, I think you should go to this. This was like right after Len Edelman had done his.
Who was your program director?
It was a guy named, at the time, it was a guy named Mike Marin, to whom I give a huge amount of credit for having recognized that, you know, that this stuff could happen and for giving me the first, you know, money directly to do it, as opposed to, you know, stuff I had to bootleg.
Okay.
Mike called me up or sent me an email or something in 95, and he said, Ned, you should go to this meeting. And that was in 18 years of teaching classes, that was the first time that I canceled a class on short notice. I mean, I cancel classes all the time, but these are for meetings that I know about on the first day of the semester.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I just, you know, said, no class tomorrow or whatever.
Okay.
And I went down there for that. That's where I met Eric Winfrey and Paul Rodiman and Len Edelman, for that matter. And, you know, Winfrey started talking about using our systems as he didn't even use it. I mean, the term he was using then was cellular automata, and Wong Tiles was a term that came out later.
Okay.
You know, when he tried to formalize that a little bit, and then Eric and I started collaborating. He was a graduate student, right?
He was at Caltech at that point.
He was at Caltech then.
Yeah.
And he's been at Caltech except for a year at Princeton and not actually much less of a year, I think, than a year at MIT.
Yeah, whereas Paul did his doctoral work with Adelman at USC.
Yeah,
right?
USC. Okay. And so Eric and I started collaborating on that. Paul, I think, was still an undergrad. May still have been an undergraduate then, in 95. I'm not quite sure. And, you know, that was my first contact with that community. And, you know, I was their first contact, except for Len, who just sort of done it, you know, kind of on his own, I think, you know, was an experimentalist. So on the for the second meeting, which I think also took place at Princeton, you know, I was part of the meeting, whatever. And then I've worked for many years with Natasha Janoska at University of South Florida, she and I wound up being the people in charge of the 2001 meeting that took place in Tampa there.
Okay.
And at that meeting, and perhaps earlier, somebody else, Ann Condon, who at some point moved from Wisconsin to Vancouver, UBC, and I'm not quite sure when, she's also a computer scientist, you know, was saying, you know, this is a very scary thing to run one of these meetings, because there's no institutional infrastructure behind us. If there's a snowstorm and nobody shows up and you're guaranteeing a motel or whatever, it's coming out of your pocket. You know, so she was concerned about that. And it also, you know, here we have a group of people using the information in DNA either to make stuff or to do computation or to do whatever. And it's a kind of new community. And, you know, we're not going to get recognized, particularly our young people. I mean, by 2001, I was already on the same side of 50 that I am now.
Okay.
Not the same side of 60, but the same side of 50. And, you know, young people need recognition, they need awards. Old people need recognition and awards, too.
Yeah.
We expect to get winners. And, you know, people are constantly trying to, you know, people constantly saying that, oh, well, you know, you're not one of us, right? I mean, I've had discussions with numerous people about potential nomination to the Academy, right? And they all say the same thing, you know? I broached it to the biochemists, but they said, well, yeah, you know, he's good, but he's not one of us. And the same with the chemists, the same with the bio. I've been nominated, I think, in four different divisions now. But, you know, nobody wants to go for one of these interdisciplinary nominations, because then you're giving something up from your division sooner or later. And you're, and who knows what division the person is going to choose to join, because it's apparently your choice when selected. And, you know, everybody, you know, the chemists want chemists, the biochemists want biochemists, people who are clearly, you know, one of the boys, or one of the boys and girls these days, not somebody who's sort of, you know, coming in at this discipline from left field.
Okay.
You know, or is only taking a little bit of this discipline and combining it with that. You know, I mean, some people think that that's, you know, how progress happens. And other people think that that's, you know, that, well, you know, nine out of ten of these people are just, you know, cranks or whatever. You know, and for all I know. And, you know, I was kind of regarded that way for a while. It's okay. That's just the way it works. You know, I mean, you know, this is impossible. This is ridiculous. This is obvious. This is sort of the trajectory of any idea. And in fact, you know, I told you I did my my main postdoctoral work with Alex Rich, the good postdoctoral work. You know, the stuff I did with the asshole at Columbia is another issue. But I mean, I did good work there. But he and I got along like oil and water, as we say. But Alex was talking about, at this thing on Friday, this symposium, he was talking about how he had actually invented hybridization, which was true. You know, it was a throwaway paragraph in a paper in 1956, published in JAX. I mean, and it was coincidental that he was going to talk about that. They actually had a slide up that had the whole paper on it. It was about so long, you know, reduced, you know, about a column of a relatively short volume. The journals were long, and there's one paragraph there. You know, people might find it useful to be able to take what he had done was take poly A and poly U, put them together, and demonstrated. I mean, the main point of the paper is he demonstrated that he got a kind of A-form helical diffraction pattern out of that, and that hence RNA could form a double helix.
Okay,
something that wasn't so evident beforehand, but he said, you know, hybridization. He said he walked out of his lab and he ran into a guy who was a well-known sort of standard biochemist, and said, "I just got poly A and poly U to come together to form a double helix." Okay. He said, "What? Without an enzyme? Impossible." You know, that was the paradigm in 1956, and they said, "Listen, you know, these guys are negatively charged. They're going to come together." Ridiculous. They're all crawled up in solution. They're going to uncoil and come together to form a duplex. Ridiculous. You know, I mean, have you thought about the entropic considerations? It's nonsense to get two things to form one thing. Nonsense. But in fact, of course, it works. And, you know, I mean, virtually everything that happens in molecular biology is based on, you know, not to mention everything that happens in what I regard as my field, happens as a consequence of hybridization. I mean, I was told that I couldn't get four strands to come together. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I knew that was wrong because I knew you could get two strands to come together, and sooner or later, you know, with that branch point, you know, the boundary condition had to be right. Mm-hmm. You know, that if you made them long enough, who would even know about this you know, fault in the middle, mm-hmm. right? So I knew it was going to work eventually. But, you know, I mean, you know, Alex had to, you know, face that kind of crap for a couple of years. But sooner or later, other people repeated, you know, the work, and it does seem to work. it's always that way. Uh-huh. You know, things go from impossible to obvious. Who gives a shit? You know, I mean, of course.
Yeah, okay. You know? Yeah. So tell me more about the... I'm sorry, I keep messing up the acronym.
Society?
The ISN, it doesn't really roll off the tongue, right?
No, it doesn't.
So, I mean, it was started in 2001.
In 2001, I was waiting for a plane in the... So Ann Condon, I was saying, you know, was concerned about, you know, the fact that there was no society behind any of this, and hence anybody who was hosting one of the meetings, you know, be it in this country or elsewhere, was, you know, up against it for... potentially a lot of cash that they might or might not have. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so we decided to put together a society, you know, where there would be some dues and some, you know, and some, you know. Mm-hmm. And the other reason, of course, is to make sure that people can get appropriate recognition.
Okay.
You know, that the field can get recognition by giving out prizes, mm-hmm. and individuals can get recognition by receiving prizes, mm-hmm. because the ACS isn't going to give anybody a prize, mm-hmm. Who does this kind of thing. I mean, I did win one ACS award, but I'm not an ACS guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm not a big fan of going to meetings with 20,000 people.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. I've gone to ACS meetings because if invited to speak at, you know, some symposium, but as a rule, I don't go to an ACS meeting.
Yeah.
And you know, the ACS seems to me to be an organization that exists largely to recognize its own members. I mean, every issue of CNE News, you know, here are our 10 XYZ scholars, here are our 20, ABC medalists, you know, and they keep going and going.
Yeah, the American Physical Society is kind of the same way.
Yeah, I'm sure it must be. Yeah. And you know, when I got into the Crystallography Society, which was my, you know, sort of original home society, and I'm still a member, they had maybe one, maybe zero awards. Now they've got about half a dozen or something.
Okay.
They all do that because, you know, there are more and more people, you know, gathered under the umbrella of the society, and they need recognition, and they're not going to get it from the other societies.
Okay, so this is a way then to help nurture a community.
Yeah, it's the way to help nurture a community.
So what disciplines are people being drawn into? I mean, the word, you know, nanoscale science, computation, engineering. Yeah. So who does this bring in?
So who's one of the interesting things about this, one of the things that gives me a small advantage, but only small, is that the people who are, you know, ISN, who were in the beginning, people from who are in DNA-based computation and in other aspects of nanoscience, were largely not chemists.
Okay.
Either they come from physics or computer science, for the most part, math. And on the other end, some biologists were also involved in the beginning, but not so much anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the first meeting, I was the only experimentalist who showed up.
This is the Princeton meeting in 95.
The Princeton meeting in 95.
Okay.
At the second and third meetings, every computer scientist showed up with a tame biochemist in tow. Okay? And by the fourth or fifth meeting, 2001 was the seventh meeting, those people had decided, well, you know, this was cute, but, you know, I've got to work up my enzyme, or I've got to do my thing with DNA repair, or I've got to do my whatever thing it is, and, you know, this may be cute, and, you know, if a couple of very young people were involved in it for a while because it gave them a chance to sort of add credentials and citations and whatever to their career path, but by and large, those tame biochemists had, you know, gone the way of the passenger pigeon, okay? They were not they weren't there anymore by about the fourth or fifth year.
So where did they migrate to?
They just went back to biochemistry. You know, one of the things about interdisciplinary sciences, and boy, is all this stuff interdisciplinary, is that interdisciplinary, it's very hard to get interdisciplinary stuff to work because everybody has demands from their own primary discipline, right? You know, and to, you know, then to get it to be fixed into a university structure is almost impossible. So, you know, and you know, in my experience, I've only been in two universities, but it's been very clear that in both of them, particularly up in Albany, you know, the word interdisciplinary is enshrined by deans and provosts. Okay, because what they can say, a typical provost, such as the one we had up there, I think there was called, you know, vice president for academic affairs, will say, I can take a group from here, let's say the artists, and a group from here, say the scientists, and I can claim that I can make them part of the same, you know, artists and science. I'm just pulled two things out of the air.
Sure.
I have the Art and Science Initiative at Albany, and I can keep that going maybe for 5 years till I can get out of this dump and be a president somewhere else. And I will have part of my credentials will be that I will establish an interdisciplinary program for no money, because I'm not giving any money more money to art, and not giving any more money to whatever science it was that came together. So free. It comes free to the administrators. They're going to love it. You know, and at the same time, I'm interdisciplinary. What a buzzword! You know, and I've created it. What a buzzword!
Yeah.
And you know, you just see that all the time. And of course, you know, it's like, you know, two parents, you know, who drag their children of roughly the same age and totally different interests together and say, "You and you play," right? You know, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work, right? The only thing they have in common is age, so maybe it doesn't. And that's sort of what happens on the faculty level. In my experience, interdisciplinary, this, that, and the other. So to keep interdisciplinary things going is very hard. Everybody's got to feel like they're getting something out of it. I mean, it's like any other collaboration in a way that, you know, I can't tell you how many people have approached me at meetings and said, gee, you know, can you, you know, send me some of your stuff or... can you bake these measurements on stuff I'll send you or whatever? And I've said yes, and I've never heard from them again. My response is always, sure, send me an email. 90% of those emails don't even arrive. I mean, it's got to be to both parties a real advantage to do it, and people love to say that they're collaborating with somebody or another, but in fact they're not. And I don't quite understand why. I mean if I'm not interested, I tell people straight off the bat. You know, look, I mean, it sounds neat, but I've got too many fish to fry, or my plate is too full, or whatever. I just can't do that right now. Why don't you go talk to
So I mean, one of the things that, you know, in terms of the rhetoric from the National Science Foundation or just the NNI in general is that, you know, nano is this wonderful interdisciplinary, you know, playground where the physicists and the biologists and the chemists are all doing their thing.
Yeah,
is that just talk?
To me, it's just talk.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I interact with physicists all the time. I interact much more rarely these days with biologists. I used to interact more with biologists and hardly at all with physicists. But, you know, if you look down the list of you know, where I give lectures, I give lectures only occasionally to biologists now, and or, you know, to biophysicists, biochemists, whatever, and much more frequently either to chemists or to physicists or occasionally to mathematicians or whatever, because the biologists aren't all that interested in what I do, so it's becoming more chemical, less biological. And yeah, and I got to say, you know, that what I do in you know, in terms of the nanotech is frankly far easier than what I do for, you know, for my NIH project. That stuff is really hard, and this stuff is, you know, relatively easy. So in fact, that I like to keep the NIH going, not just because it's the good money, because they give you twice as much as anybody else does, but also because it's actually harder, and it keeps the brain moving, working a little harder to solve the problem.
Okay, so for the ISN SCE, again, coming back to, you know, so when you look at it, what disciplines is it?
Well, basically, it's computer scientists and chemists.
Okay.
I shouldn't say chemists, really, because some of them really come from physics.
Mm-hmm.
And, and if I don't count my own students, of whom two are relatively prominent in the organization,
mm-hmm.
there are about two other chemists there. And then, you know, there's some from biology. I mean, you know, some of the people who show up at the meetings or invited to the meetings are kind of chemists, kind of biochemists. It's hard to say. But, in terms of, like, real, like, live synthetic chemists and whatever, I could name two.
Hmm.
That's it. There may be and the rest of us can occasionally do a little bit of synthetic chemistry, either by collaborating with a real organic chemist or by, following a literature procedure that's, pretty straightforward, and we can kind of figure out how to reflect something
mm-hmm.
with luck.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
So I'll come back to that in a second, but I wanted to also ask you, how does DNA, structural DNA nanotechnology relate to DNA computing? Because, I'm on the back of even further. I went to the Caltech meeting, a couple months ago?
DNA 17.
Yeah, and I was just really trying to understand how people who are doing, looking at the posters, trying to see how the people who are doing structural DNA nanotech are relating to the computer, people, trying to see how they intersected.
Yeah, it was my experience. One of the things about DNA-based computation is that so far nobody's done anything that's significantly up from a toy calculation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of the growth in DNA nanotech, let's not add structural even necessarily,
mm-hmm.
came because, insofar as I could tell, a fair number of the people in DNA-based computation really didn't see that it was going anywhere, and they saw that what I was doing
mm-hmm.
was easier.
Okay.
And and what they wound up doing is sort of, what they've brought to the party is logic. Okay.
Hmm.
I don't mean that what I did was illogical. I'm talking about logic in a more formal sense.
Sure.
That, when we make things, when I think about making things, or at least up until became involved with those folks, I thought about making things of, here's sticky end A, and it's going to go to A prime, and B goes to B prime, and C goes to C prime,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. Whereas they thought in terms of taking our motifs and turning them into logic gates of one sort or another.
Okay.
So, for instance, what Winfrey was supposed to do for his thesis, and eventually Paul Rodman wound up doing in his lab,
mm-hmm.
was to make a so-called Sierpinski triangle.
Yeah,
you know what that is.
I read the paper. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So it's seven tiles that makes a fractal. There's no way I could make that with the initial approach that mm-hmm. I had of A goes to A prime, B goes to B prime.
Okay.
On the other hand, much as I like that approach and much as I appreciate it, their error rates are just off scale.
Okay.
You can't do serious computation with a really faulty computer, insofar as I can tell.
Okay.
You can get the equivalent of parity checks or whatever, but then the computer hangs up.
Mm-hmm.
You're done.
Mm-hmm.
But they brought logic to DNA nanotech,
mm-hmm.
and that means that we have a broader set of things we can make. They do other things in terms of logic gates.
Mm-hmm.
this recent stuff of Eric's, with these, successive toehold things and so forth. All of that is, good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of merged the two areas. Basically, those people are doing stuff, except for the addition of logic that we were doing, before. Because they saw that what we're doing, in terms of making stuff, is actually easier. They're just not going to compete with silicon in terms of speeds or anything else, I think, ever.
So what are the potential applications for it, other than the fact that, that some see it as inherently interesting?
I think the organization of, nanoelectronics, nanophotonics, all that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
This is, after all, what are you going to do with nanoelectronics? You're going to build computers, but you're going to do it, from the hardware point of view rather than the software point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I regard what Len Edelman did as using DNA for software,
huh.
right? Okay. I mean, you know, here's the DNA, and you know, we get the DNA to spew out an answer, but it's not really. I wouldn't call what he did using DNA for hardware, for organizing hardware. It was. I mean, for a while there were discussions of, well, you know, we could have a swimming pool full of DNA and all that, mm-hmm. and you know, then work out hard problems. My interest in all that was that, in a way, this mimicked what happens in the cell. A chemist takes 2, 3, 4 components, throws something between 10 to the 12th and 10 to the 18th copies of them in a pot, stirs them up, and gets out 1, 2, or 3 products. Mm-hmm. You know, the cell has at most 1,000 and often many fewer copies of 10 to the, so let's say, 8th or 9th different components, not counting the water, and they're all present in very small quantities, and you know, and so that what the DNA computation people were talking about in the early days was very much like what happened in the cell, and I figured this is an interesting way to emulate, you know, the logic that goes on in the cell and so forth, because you have tons of components and not much, and not many copies of every one of them.
Yeah.
So it may be a different way of looking at what happens, okay. in living systems.
Is there any parallel with what the DNA computing people were doing versus what you and Robinson had talked about with the biochip?
No. Okay, what Robinson and I were talking about was using DNA to organize other stuff.
Okay. Yeah. So this is another kind of broad question, but people oftentimes talk about, you know, paradigms for particular fields. You know, what would you say is the, you know, basic paradigm for DNA nanotechnology? You know, like the basic guiding principle, or?
Well, up until a few years ago, I'd have said, you know, gain control by trashing symmetry. Hmm. But in fact, Chengde Mao has shown that in fact, if you maximize symmetry, you often do better than if you minimize symmetry, okay. in some regards, and I regard that as a technical triumph for him, and he would probably say the same thing, because if you only need 3 strands to do the work of 30, you only have to purify 3 strands, you know, and you only have to get the stoichiometry right between 3 strands, mm-hmm. rather than between 30, and you know, the purifications always suck. And mm-hmm. synthetic DNA isn't all that good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I made my career off of synthetic DNA. But there have been at least 2 occasions when interacting our DNA with enzymes that we actually had to make the DNA using enzymes and you know, ATP and, you know, NTP, mm-hmm. Rather than you know, on the synthesizer, and in order to get the right answer or the answers. I mean, mm-hmm. both of them. One of them was when we discovered there was an RNA topoisomerase. The way we did that was to transcribe an RNA strand off a piece of DNA. Mm-hmm. And in principle, you're supposed to get about one for every DNA molecule, you're supposed to get 50 to 100 RNA molecules. Mm-hmm. And we were getting 2. And when we PCR'd the stuff up, mm-hmm. you know, so it was all normal DNA, then we got our 100 too. Mm-hmm. And then in a DNA computing application, published maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago, in order for the problem, I mean, it was a toy problem, for the problem to work correctly, one of the edges, we had a graph, and the question was, is it 3 colorable or not? So you have a given graph, and the question is, can you color the vertices with 3 different colors, such that no edge is flanked by the same color. Mm-hmm. So in order to do that, we worked up a system whereby we restricted the graph that we constructed, and those edges that were flanked by the same color, the strands going, you know, from one vertex to the other, mm-hmm. Would wound up being had to be restricted. And, you know, they had to go to zero, right? You know, nothing left of that stuff. Then what was left, we could, you know, we could characterize. And what we found was that, in fact, one of the edges just didn't go to zero. You know, no matter how much restriction and something we threw in, and finally I had the student, you know, just make it biologically, and then it worked okay.
Okay.
So, you know, so we've had a couple of problems with the synthetic DNA, and... I've forgotten the question that started this.
I was asking about kind of like a paradigm or like
Set of ideas. So trash symmetry.
Yeah.
So
but you're saying now it's you think it's more symmetry rather than less symmetry.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that if we were technically more adept,
okay,
then the principle would be right. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are in science what we call Pauling points, right? When you make one fewer approximations, you go further from the right answer. So, you know, you go like this, then you go like that, then you go like that. And so that's one fewer approximations, or, you know, do things, you know, I mean, experimentally, do things more correctly rather than less correctly. And, you know, there's n components there. And it turns out we happen to be at one of those points where the technical aspects of things are overtaking the logical aspects of things.
Okay.
So no, I don't believe that that's overall true, but it's something we have to do for the time being because we purify our material so badly or whatever.
So coming back to the F Nano meetings, we talked a little bit about the people who go to it, but I mean, how many people show up for these typically?
Oh, you know, of the order of 100, 250.
So it's a fairly small community, though.
It's a small community at F Nano. And it's also small. Well, you saw the size of DNA 17. It was about the same. A
couple hundred, maybe.
Yeah, the F Nano is in one place always.
Okay.
Right, and that's a place where the guy who organized it has contacts at Snowbird in Utah.
Ah, okay.
So, I mean, I'm not a skier, but I've been to the ski resort now about 7 or 8 times. I guess we've done 7 meetings. I'm not quite sure. I think we started in 04. Maybe it's 8 meetings now. And it's always there. So this is a little more, a little less computational, a little more physics, chemistry sort of meeting.
Okay.
For whatever reason.
I wanted to get your thoughts. Okay, so let me just preface this. So in any of the review articles on DNA nanotech that, you know, Science or Nature publishes, there's sort of like a standard narrative that shows up. I mean, there starts with your work, where you're referred to as the father of DNA nanotechnology, and I'm curious to know what your own reaction is to that. But then it talks about Adelman's work, it talks about Paul's work, a little, maybe it'll mention Eric's work, but I kind of want to get your sense of, you know, what do you think of that sort of overall thumbnail description of how the field developed?
Well, certainly I was there first.
I mean,
you know, I mean, I was there, you know, nearly 15 years before Adelman was. And then, you know, Adelman really isn't. Adelman sort of dipped in and dipped out of the field. I mean, there were a lot of people who dipped in and dipped out.
Okay.
And he was one of them. I mean, Adelman's a really smart guy. So when he dipped in, it wasn't just a, you know, we got some of his toe fungus in there. I mean, we got, you know, it was a substantial substantial contribution,
yeah.
Right? I'd say that there have been two. I mean, Eric, you know, sort of worked with, Eric is a very smart guy. I don't think his contributions to nanotech have been as much as his contributions to DNA computation. He's a very smart guy. I mean, basically what happened was when we agreed to collaborate, he was supposed to make the Sierpinski triangle and we were supposed to make a periodic array, but he realized when he finally got around to doing it that the first thing to do was to make the periodic array, and he was simply better than my graduate student, right? And so he got there a little bit ahead of my student, so we published together, and you know, it was a nice collaboration there. And he's done other things with it. With that system, I mean, I don't think they've gone very far beyond DX in terms of motifs and so forth. Maybe some TXs. I would say the two, you know, if you want to talk about after me, who made the two major contributions?
Yeah.
I would say Paul with origami, without question.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one, who keeps not getting what I feel is appropriate recognition, is Bernie Yerke with toehold-based isothermal strain displacement. Now, one of my students, you know, my students in my class present papers, and one of them just presented a paper where she kept talking about something that sounded like iso, and I downloaded the paper, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet, a paper that talked about isothermal strain displacement. She kept talking about a 1981 paper, and maybe Bernie got it from that, I don't know, but it certainly wasn't... I never heard of the people who wrote that paper, and you know, and all that. But those were the, you know, if somebody was said to me, Ned, you know, all right, you got your Cavley, who should get the next one? I would split it between Bernie and Paul.
Hmm.
All right, I mean, Paul came up with, you know, I mean, the important thing, in my opinion, about origami is not the part about the smiley faces.
Yeah.
It's the part about where he made that map of the Western Hemisphere. He's shown mm-hmm. that you can relatively easily put a couple hundred addressable points together,
mm-hmm.
you know, individually addressable points together, and that was his main contribution. You know, when you start looking at origami,
mm-hmm.
the first thing you say is, wow, it's so big.
Yeah.
The second thing you say is, shit, it's so small. I mean, because we made a 2D, I wanted to combine nanomechanical devices mm-hmm. and 2D arrays
mm-hmm.
before Paul did his work. And we took a TX motif
mm-hmm.
and connected them 1-3 like that, so that in a row like this we had four helices worth of thickness.
Okay.
And we had to take four in one and four in the next row, so we had eight different ones,
mm-hmm.
which was a real pain in the ass for the student who was doing it, so we could put something in there that would flip back and forth that we could see on the AFM.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned, you know, the origami was big, but it was only three times as big as those eight tiles. So eight, that's a lot, and we would never go back to doing that with eight tiles.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, you know, one of the things that we published not long ago was that we went to making it with, making 2D origami crystals,
mm-hmm.
because at least M13 is pretty small, and it gets... These are really expensive experiments.
Mm-hmm.
You start fucking around with your origamis, and you have 200 staple strands or 250 staple strands, and you want any kind of quality from them, so you don't buy them from Bioneer. You usually get them from IDT.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's a lot of money. I mean,
the expenses coming from the size of, or the length of the...
The number of DNA strands that you have to buy, each uh-huh. at, you know, X number of cents per nucleotide.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, William Shee can, you know, has sort of pushed his research to do that,
mm-hmm.
all right? He's taking origami, he and his German postdocs are taking origami as far as it can go,
mm-hmm.
and the Weiss Institute, he's got, you know, he's got slightly more money than God. I don't know how much more money than God. And he's able to invest in experiments like I would never dream of doing. It's the story of my career. You have to be smart rather than rich in order to get things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not saying William isn't smart,
yeah.
but William is very rich.
What was your reaction to Paul's paper when you first, did you read a preprint of it? Or
Paul presented the work
hmm.
In the fall, at that summer meeting in Albany. I had just asked him to give a talk.
Yeah.
At that summer meeting in Albany in 2005. So I was well aware of it 8 months beforehand,
mm-hmm.
and it was great stuff. And then I reviewed the paper also.
Okay.
And, you know, I asked a couple questions he didn't, you know, as a reviewer that he didn't really answer, which is, you know, sort of okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, one of the things about origami is, you know, I mean, Paul talks about pixelation.
Mm.
My word is resolution. He never really did answer what's the resolution of an origami, namely if you take 100 or 1,000 or some appropriate number of them and you superimpose them by the best algorithm you've got,
mm-hmm.
and then you Fourier transform that pattern,
mm-hmm.
how far out in space, in reciprocal space, you know what that is?
I remember, yes.
In scattering space,
yeah.
how far out do you get what's equivalent of Bragg peaks?
Okay.
That's, you know, that's resolution.
Mm-hmm.
So he used the term pixelation, which may be unfair to him,
mm-hmm.
but his pixelation is 60 angstroms, all right?
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of 4.
Okay.
Okay? So, that you know, and I'm pissed off that I can't do better than 4 right now. Maybe we can. Maybe we can get down to 3.5. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we're doing experiments to see if we can do that. Having to do with the way we freeze our crystals and shit.
Okay.
But that's, so Paul is exploiting, as far as I'm concerned, a different size regime from what we're exploiting. I mean, we use it when we need to.
Yeah.
I mean, so for instance, the nanoscale assembly line that we made,
mm-hmm.
that's a nanoscale assembly line, and we're taking 5-nanometer particles and putting them together on this walker and so forth. You know, which I consider to be like the chassis of a car going through a Detroit factory.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a kid who's, well, we'll get him his degree and get him out of here. He's trying to make it a little more complex.
Mm-hmm.
He's not as good as the first student that did that by a lot. That should not go in.
We can edit that out.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Along with my language, right?
Some of that I'd like to keep.
All right. Well, whatever. I mean, everybody knows that I speak in a rather salty fashion.
Yeah.
I would very much like to be able to shrink the scale of what we're doing there,
mm-hmm.
from putting together nanoparticles to putting together molecules.
Okay.
In principle, we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Without even protecting groups. One of the key things we showed in that piece of work was that even in solution, and of course we could always tie them down to a solid support,
mm-hmm.
the origamis almost never talked to each other. So we had less than 1%, at least with 3 additions, we had less than 1% wrong answers. We had yield problems like everybody else. It was like, I think, 75 squared,
mm-hmm.
For all the way down there.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that had to do with the fact that the origami is so damn small, we couldn't make a bigger walker.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that the walker was a certain size, and then what was on this corner and this corner and this corner were starting to talk to one another. If you tried to put, or these two would talk to the third guy, you'd have trouble getting him on.
And, okay.
You know, so there's steric issues.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we do it with nanoparticles? The answer is we could deal with under a nanomole, or with about a nanomole, sorry, with a femtomole of material, nanomolar concentrations, in the TEM, to get to a mass spec.
Mm-hmm.
At least at the time, we needed maybe as much as a picomole, rather than a femtomole of material. Okay. So at some point we'd like to goose it all up to the point where we could characterize our products and the thing we're making with mass spec,
mm-hmm.
rather than with actually cherry picking whatever the hell we made and tossing it into the, or cherry picking our answers,
mm-hmm.
out of the TEM. We do. There's a lot of that goes on in this business, and I'm the first to recognize it, and I'm the first to admit that we do it.
So some of the TEM data that you're getting is not.
It's not unrepresentative.
Okay.
But, you know, some of the things we do, you know, you're talking about very small numbers that you were actually able to get onto a TEM grid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're hoping that what we got was, in fact, the good stuff.
Okay.
We're hoping, we know it's the good stuff, we're hoping it's the average stuff,
mm-hmm.
and not a lucky punch for that sample.
Okay. Right? Tell me a little bit, if you would, about, as you've been part of this field now for, you know, all these years. Yeah. What do you see as major controversies or, you know, either technical or personality-wise, that you are able to speak about or care to?
Well, I don't think there really are too many technical
mm-hmm.
Controversies yet. We haven't really got to that point. I mean, every once in a while you see stuff, I see stuff that I think is kind of crappy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to mention any names there.
Yeah.
But, you know, stuff that, you know, if I had enough money and enough time and enough resources, you know, I would probably go out and repeat because I don't trust it.
Okay.
That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of rare. And, you know, sort of like in the generation after the generation of my students.
I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, when the F nano meetings or the DNA X meetings happen, mm-hmm. you know, is there one particular group of people that, you know, is aligned with this particular way of thinking and this one? Okay, so it hasn't developed.
Not so much that way. I mean, there's some people who don't think about things the way I think about things.
Yeah.
Probably nobody thinks about things the way I think about things. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at a certain point, you know, you've imposed your way of thinking on the field. You know, most people do think about it that way. I mean, I had the same thing happen in my youth, you know, when I was a crystallographer. I mean, this so-called paper we mentioned briefly, my most cited paper until recently.
Mm-hmm.
And so now my most cited paper is the 2D array with Winfrey.
Yeah.
But the one that's number two there is this recognition of nucleic acids by hydrogen bonding from proteins. And, you know, a lot of people said, you know, that was really poorly written. And I said, yeah, it is poorly written, because I was coming up with the concepts for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even in this this sort of founding paper of this field, the one in J. Theor by all,
mm-hmm.
You know, I put together notations, and, you know, I use terms that I've tried to eliminate.
Huh.
You know, it's something that somebody young does when they... you know, when they're trying to invent something and they don't have the words there yet,
mm-hmm.
right? And then, you know, and then I'm embarrassed now when people use these words from, you know, from 30 years ago. That
like
are,
what?
Criton and whatnot.
Criton? I don't even recall that. What is a criton?
That was like the criterion length of, you know, how long the piece is, you know, when you're choosing your symmetry.
So sort of like a codon, a criton, was that kind of
Codon was three. Criton could be any length, but it was the criterion that you were using to minimize your symmetry.
What would you call it now? Or what do you call it?
Like in the second paper, even when I sort of goosed it up with a better program,
mm-hmm.
I called it just an element or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. there were words in the English language that weren't coming. So I made up a word. Nothing uh-huh. more pompous than that. But you know, as you get older, you learn some things you shouldn't do, and, mm-hmm. and that was one of them. So that was there. There aren't really that many controversies. I mean, there's a lot of questions, you know, to where everything should be going and for what purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you see that in every article about it. You know, when you know the wider scientific community looks at DNA nanotech.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, I mean, there are a lot of things that I just want to do that I want to know whether they can be done, and. Because they seem to me to be, you know, appropriate things to do. I mean, I think we could do automatic weaving with these systems, for instance.
What would that mean?
And it's something we're eventually going to get to. I mean, we published a preliminary paper this fall, where just taking DNA strands and having them weave themselves together into a braid.
Huh.
Okay, we've done the smallest possible braid at this point. Which is a Solomon's knot. I don't know if you quite know.
I remember seeing the pictures of
yeah,
that.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, and in that paper we showed pictures of a braided mosaic from Canimbriga in Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
And to show, you know, where we'd like to go. And the work that I do with Jim Canary, which I don't know if we've talked about that really, where, you know, this is an idea that he and I have been working on now for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard. Okay, which is to attach polymer components to the 2' position effectively RNA, because there's no 2' in DNA.
Okay.
And this is the position where that hydroxyl sits.
Okay.
That makes RNA, not DNA.
Mm-hmm.
If you look down an RNA helix, maybe you can see it on this ADNA helix. Maybe you can't because the model's kind of crappy. Now the other one, that's what an RNA helix looks like. You can see it's different. There's a hole down the middle.
Where do you see the hole?
Just look down the helix axis. You can see a hole.
Okay.
Right. The atom furthest, if you look on a better model than this one, the atom furthest from the helix axis is the hydroxyl that sort of, I mean, here's the position.
Uh-huh.
Let's fuck that up. No, I don't think so. Yeah, this is a two-prime position, and if you had the hydroxyl out here, this is actually the out here is where the hydrogen would be, and the oxygen is a little further out.
Mm-hmm.
That's the atom furthest from the helix axis.
Okay.
So we've been trying to attach stuff to that for years and years and years, and of course we've gotten somewhere. We've made a sort of nylon polymer, and we're trying to do other things. Because there are other chemistries that are actually going to make it a little bit easier to do that. And the idea is to direct the topology of some other polymer using the topology of DNA. I mean, DNA, there are circles in which I am known as the father of single-stranded synthetic DNA topology.
Okay.
Rather than the father of the other.
We haven't talked about that.
No, we haven't.
Okay.
We've published a relatively small number of papers. Only one other guy has ever picked up on it. I don't regard his experimental work as being as closely controlled as ours. But it's there,
mm-hmm.
right? So in the early 90s, we made a bunch of knots. And we stopped making knots because we couldn't characterize our products.
Mm-hmm.
If you make a knot with three nodes, it's a trefoil knot, and you can tell, and it migrates like something in a gel. It migrates faster than the so-called unknot, the circle.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a knot with four nodes.
Mm-hmm.
It'll migrate faster yet, with the same number of nucleotides. And you can demonstrate in other ways that it really has four nodes, because the fourth node was made out of Z-DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could make two domains that had Z-DNA in them and make the other-handed version of that first trefoil knot.
Hmm.
And we made the trefoil knot in two or three different ways, depending on your count. But when you get to five-noded knots, it turns out there are two topoisomers. There's a five-noded knot that looks sort of like I could draw them. They're different, okay?
But what's a topoisomer?
It's a topological isomer of something, right?
Okay.
So if my fingers are linked like this, if we talk about cat names too, okay?
Yeah.
This would be a cat name of, say, two links of a chain.
Okay.
But if I could wrap my finger all the way around itself and link twice around here, then that would be a topoisomer of this same notion.
Okay.
And with the knots, I mean, there's like one kind of three and four noted knot, not counting handedness.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two kinds of five noted knot, three kinds of six noted knot, 49 kinds of nine noted knot, and by the time you get up to about 13, you're in the tens of thousands.
Hmm.
Okay, all just different sort of, intralacings, mm-hmm. if you will, of the strand. And the only way to demonstrate those reliably is by looking at them, by structure looking at them. The things that we look at are too small to see in the AFM.
Okay.
So we would need something else. And crystallography is now, lends itself to that.
Yeah.
But the weaving is another story altogether, because if you're doing it on a large scale, even if there's a flaw in the weave, so there's a flaw in the weave, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
You're doing molecular scale weaving.
Hmm.
So you can make, conceivably you could make, a stronger version of Kevlar or whatever.
Okay. So you've mentioned AFM and TEM. I kind of wanted to get a sense of, for people in your community, What are the common instruments that you have to use in order to be competent?
A gel box and AFM, TEM only if you're. We have only used TEM to look at metallic nanoparticles. I guess we've only looked at metallic nanoparticles at this point, but there are others we're going to look at. And then that's. I mean, other than that, the typical biochemistry lab equipment, you'd have to have a spectrophotometer and whatever.
Okay.
Fluorimeters are useful.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, like Chengde, looks at constructs in the TEM. I mean, so things without heavy atoms on them in the TEM.
Mm-hmm.
Using cryo-TEM. We're not skilled at that, so we haven't done that. I think we're still the only group doing crystallography.
Huh.
Huh. There are other groups that want to do it desperately, but they're not trained in crystallography until one of them, which is going to happen someday, you know, pulls down, you know, enough bucks to hire a crystallographer, or gambles on hiring a crystallographer who's much better than I am and wouldn't take very much, then, you know, then we're going to remain the only group doing crystallography.
So tell me about the other good groups that are working in the field now. I mean, if you know.
Well, I'd say, you know, my two students, Hao Yan and Cheng Jun Mao, are both strong.
Uh-huh.
William Shi is obviously strong.
Yeah.
You know, the Winfrey Pierce Rodemund axis at Caltech is strong. Turberfield mm-hmm. is strong.
Turberfield's at Oxford, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fritz Simmel is strong.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Yerke is strong. I'm not quite sure how much he's doing because he works mostly with undergraduates.
He's at Idaho.
Boise State. I just visited him a couple months ago.
Yeah.
He retired from Bell.
Okay, because I just, you know, all those schools that you just mentioned you know, the elite schools, and then it's Boise State, and that always struck me as an outlier.
Right. Well, that's because he retired from there, and he's from there. His father's there and old and whatever.
Okay.
For him, it's like, you know, for them, it's like, you know, Einstein walking into the middle of the mountains and saying, got anything I can do here?
Okay. Who's the guy at Duke? Levine?
Levine just moved to NC State.
Okay, and Reif is at Duke still.
At Duke, yeah. So Levine is now starting his own independent.
Okay.
I mean, he was sort of independent before.
Paul suggested I ask you about Reif because I guess.
Why?
It seemed like an interesting personality with lots of ideas.
Yeah, Reif is an interesting guy with some really smart ideas. Some people find him a little on the over aggressive side.
Mm-hmm.
And. He hasn't taken anything from me that I know of, but he's the kind of guy who just regards, you know, everything. You know, some people get reputations for being a little bit grabby, and so if he sees something that he's reviewing, he has no compunctions about putting out the paper that's the logical successor to what he just reviewed.
Isn't that viewed as sort of violating a community norm?
Yeah. It is. There's some people who you know, are less fond of Reif than I am.
Okay.
Because he hasn't done that to me.
Mm-hmm.
Two other labs that I didn't mention are the two chemists in the business.
Mm.
One is Hanadi Sleiman in Montreal, McGill.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was a Jean-Marie Lane product.
Okay.
As a postdoc. And the other is Kurt Gotthelf at Aarhus. And now I'm trying to think, is there anybody else? Oh, there's William Shi, of course.
Yeah.
And then, you know, much more on the DNA computation side of things, there are the Israelis, there's Kobe Benenson, who I think is back in Israel now.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people like Uri Sivan and who's the other guy he published with? The name will come to me. Erez Brown. You know, I think they're both in Haifa, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, then depending how far afield you want to go, you can think of people like Roy Barzeev, who are much more biologically tilted.
Mm-hmm.
And. Then, you know, there's a group in Spain that one of my former students, a postdoc in Ertija, I think his name is.
Mm-hmm.
My student may be staying there, she may be leaving too. I mean, I recommended her for something somewhere else. You know. There's nobody really in France that I can think of. There are people doing nano and, you know, who add DNA to it, but that's not quite the same
mm-hmm.
thing. There are other groups where, you know, you know, you see their names, and they come around. Somebody at Brigham Young, I always forget his name.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see papers to review that are, you know, they're just out there,
mm-hmm.
and you're not quite sure who is this guy or this gal, and what are they doing, and I never heard of them, and, you know, mm-hmm. what's going on. And, you know, for a while I kept a list of, you know, those names, some of which you don't see again, and mm-hmm. sometimes you do. And, you know, it's like 60, 70 laboratories that are out there.
Okay.
There's, you know, at the major institutions, there aren't so many other people. But then you got to ask things like, you know, is what Chad Merkin does what we do or not?
Yeah.
Is what Oleg Gong does what we do or not?
What's the other name?
Oleg Gong.
Okay.
He's at Brookhaven.
Okay.
Okay. You know, there are small, I mean, there's a relatively small time lab at Brookhaven run by Bill Sherman, my former postdoc. Mm-hmm.
I think of Merkin's work as more the dip pen lithography.
Well, no, but his first stuff was taking nanoparticles and putting half of a probe on one and half of a probe on another, and then if he threw it in a pot, they would be brought together by, you know, the DNA or RNA or whatever for some AIDS protein.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you bring these guys together, they there's some plasmonic event and they change color.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first thing Merkin did.
Hmm. Okay.
And Paul Alvesados was, I guess, the first guy who added DNA to nanoparticles to try to make stuff with them. It was very similar to what he did. He did this sort of with Pete Schultz. Pete's not doing this stuff. It was, you know, DNA plus nanoparticles. And Paul's done things like make an asymmetric tetrahedron, that type of thing. I mean, Paul is quite a star in his own right, but it's a different area. I mean, he's now the director of LBL.
Hmm.
And he was a founder of the Liquid Foundry and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think of
him more for quantum dots, but that's...
Yeah, well, the quantum dots, many of the quantum dots had DNA attached to them.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. Okay.
Some of them did, anyway.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and then there's Vilner in Israel, too.
Mm-hmm.
Itamar Vilner and whatever, you know, the various things that he's done. And, you know, I mean, if you talk to Itamar, I mean, he's done... He did it all, you know, back in 1952 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not...
Is there a lot of work being done in China or Japan?
I'm seeing a lot of papers coming out of China, and there's work in Japan, definitely. In fact, one of my former postdocs is in Japan, and he's doing good stuff.
Uh-huh.
And there's other stuff that's, you know, related, that, you know, Hiroshi Sugiyama
mm-hmm.
is doing stuff. I'm actually sending somebody to his lab to do an experiment,
because
he has this real-time AFM. The stuff happening, I mean, one of my former students is now in China, Bao Chuan Ding, and I see Chinese papers that are, you know, somehow or another related to this stuff, and I don't know any of the players. A Chen Hai Fan I know, and he's doing stuff. There was some Korean activity for a while, but it seems to have disappeared.
Okay.
Geographically,
and, a lot of...
In Yamuna Krishnan is in India.
Okay.
Doing stuff. And I have an Indian student who's going to go back. She's right now in Humboldt in Aachen, Germany. So right now she's working for somebody else. But she worked with the Pankar Sen at Simon Fraser.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's been kind of following her husband, but she did it. Two significant pieces of work in this lab.
Okay.
And so the Pankar Sen is another person. He and Yamuna were both kind of originally tilted toward G4, C4 kinds of things. These are like special motifs from special sequences, you know, that came out of Balasubramanian's lab at Cambridge, I think.
Okay.
So
you've described a pretty big community. That's pretty.
Yeah, you know, and you know, I haven't hit all the. I mean, the experimental community. I've hit most of the high points. But then there's Andy Ellington, and I just sent somebody to him. In fact, and he's doing. He tends to be more RNA-ish than DNA-ish.
Yeah.
But one of his students just published on his student postdoc. I don't know. Just published a paper on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see, who else? I mean, so, you know, if we keep, you know, if you keep bringing up names, you know, I'm sure I would say,
okay.
Oh, yeah!
Yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
You know, so it hasn't trickled down to too many of the sort of second-level schools yet, and all the top schools aren't saturated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nobody doing nobody's still doing this stuff at Princeton. I mean, I've got a former student there as a postdoc, but he's working with somebody who's part of the computing community. But her interest was these various protozoa that, you know, have shuffled genomes and they unshuffle, and, you know, whatever.
Okay.
And he's working for her, but I don't think there's too much knowing of DNA nanotech going on there.
Okay.
I don't think at Princeton, nothing at Brown, nothing at Penn that I can think of offhand.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Well, I have a former student as a postdoc at Yale, mm-hmm. and you never know. You send a postdoc somewhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sent Hao Yan to Duke, and suddenly they were doing experiments down in Duke.
Hmm.
I mean, there's some guy from the computer science department there, Chris Dwyer, who does stuff, you know, I mean, with DNA trying to organize stuff. And to some extent, he worked with Levine.
Mm-hmm.
So the community is large, you know, and then, I mean, there are other people that I interact with, and, you know, then the question is, well, how much of that is DNA nanotech, and how much of it is, you know, I mean, I'm interacting with a guy now who works with nanotubes. We've never worked with carbon nanotubes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interacting with, I have a grant with somebody else to do things with carbon nanotubes. I'm hoping the stuff I do with the first guy will wind up pumping into that grant, and, you know, we'll be able to do significant stuff with it. And there's also Mike Norton, I forgot, and Marshall.
Okay.
He's doing stuff. So the community, you know,
yeah.
If you know, when I say this, there's at least a list of at least 60 names.
Yeah.
You know, when you get down to it, I mean, I'm not even counting. Oh, and then there's Peng Yan,
mm-hmm.
at you know, next door to William Shi at the Vice,
mm-hmm.
and then there's somebody else there who's not really part of what I regard this community, but she took a postdoc. She got a postdoc from Hanadi Sleiman. And they just made some kind of structure that does something inside a cell that,
mm-hmm.
out of RNA. This guy will eventually be a superstar.
Hmm.
Faisal Aldaya.
Hmm.
I mean, the guy, he works for Pam Silver, but Faisal Aldaya is one of the future superstars. And then there are all these, you know, other people. You know, Hao has sent students to William Shi, so that's already like third generation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean... Oh, and yeah, I keep forgetting. There are these two Germans who left Xi already and went back to Germany. One's with, I mentioned Fritz Simmel, I think.
Yeah.
But one's at the same school, and one's at, is Ludwig Maximilian University, yeah, LMU,
mm-hmm.
and Tim Lidl is there,
mm-hmm.
and he's doing good stuff already, and Hendrik Dietz is back at, TDU, Technical University.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to see if I can get one of my students to map just where all these people are. That would be helpful. Let's talk about money a little bit. And
always happy to talk about money.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about funding for research, but I kind of want to get maybe a sense of just, you know, have there been any broad shifts in terms of where your funding has been coming from over time?
Well, my money has basically, I mean, my money for this, you know, basically it doesn't come from the NIH.
Okay.
Hao was able to squeeze an NIH grant out of them. Mm-hmm. There's some kind of nanotech thing, and I think it was some kind of diagnostic thing, that we don't play in the diagnostic field because there's so many diagnosticians out there, and we're not, I mean, I don't like competing with people very much. I don't like doing, I mean, if I've got my own weird tack on something, I'll dip into a field and dip out.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we found the RNA topoisomerase. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't pursue that. Maybe I should. You know, that was 15 years ago, and nobody has touched it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my, you know, you know what H numbers are. You know, it's one of,
actually, I don't. I saw that in your CV, and not a term I'm familiar with.
Okay, so it's why people are judged. It's one of the criteria.
Okay.
So what you do is you take your papers and you sort them in order of references.
Okay, so number of citations.
Number of citations.
Yeah.
So, you know, top paper might be 1,000, the second paper might be 500, the third paper might be 300. If your fourth paper has 10, and your fifth paper has 10, and all the rest, then your H number is going to be 10.
Okay.
So, it you know, if you have a blockbuster, mm-hmm. it kind of ignores that, right? So you sort them in order. Mm-hmm. The paper that has N citations in rank order, as many citations as its rank order, mm-hmm. that's your H number.
Hmm.
Okay? So that means, you know, if you have 1,000 and then 100 tens, your H number is 10.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a blockbuster paper as a postdoc or whatever,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter. You have to keep having produced papers that somebody cited.
Mm-hmm.
So my RNA topoisomerase is well below the number of citations it's received in 15 years, puts it well below my H number.
Which is something like 60.
65, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And it's, you know, so that means, you know, so that means it's basically been ignored.
Hmm.
I mean, to the extent that I was at a meeting in Bordeaux fall a year ago,
mm-hmm.
2 years ago, I think, and some guy was talking about how complicated the weaving of RNA was mm-hmm. in some system he was working on. He was the husband of somebody with whom I've published of half a dozen or a dozen papers.
Yeah.
And I raised my hand and I said, well, you know, have you ever, you know, I you know, in one of my least cited papers, you know, we show that there is such a thing as an RNA topoisomerase. I assume that would have impact on your system. He said, well, I had never heard of that.
Mm.
You know, so,
yeah.
You know, things are often rediscovered because people don't know the literature.
Okay.
Yeah, that happens. So, but that wasn't what we were talking about. We were talking about...
About funding. In the last couple of days, you've... As I am understanding it, you talk a lot about your NIH work, and then there seems like there's everything else.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's my NIH and my non-NIH.
Yeah, so I'm trying to understand the...
Okay, so the NIH is studying biological phenomena, one mm-hmm. way or another, all right? And getting through an NIH study section to be funded, you know, it's much more of a peer review thing. It's somewhat peer review at the NSF.
Yeah.
But... It's a small number of people, and you know, if they know who you are, often that helps because you're talking about relatively small amounts of money. The NIH, you're talking about double the amount of money you're talking anywhere else,
mm-hmm.
And they want you to be solving a biological problem.
Okay.
I mean, I tell people who want NIH funding, I say, do not have anything you want to do. Have a problem you want to solve, then. Work out the very best way to solve that problem.
Okay.
If the very best way to solve that problem happens to be what you want to do, you're very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
If not, propose what it is. Propose what is the very best way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And forget what you want to do. Maybe you'll do that if you get the money.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how you have to write an NIH proposal.
Huh.
All right. You can't do the backward thinking of, I want to do this shit, and how am I going to justify it?
Okay.
It's the easiest thing in the world for a reviewer to pick up, and you just get slaughtered.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the NIH world.
Yeah.
The rest is my DNA nanotech world.
Yeah.
I mean, originally I was bootlegging it. It's not bootstrapping. It's bootlegging. I was stealing.
Okay. Right,
from the NIH grant, effectively.
Uh-huh. Stealing meaning...
Stealing means spending NIH money
mm-hmm.
to do things like to explore aspects of the branched DNA that I could conceivably justify
mm-hmm.
as being involved in the NIH. I mean, the funny story was that when we made the Cube,
mm-hmm. This is like 93?
91.
91, okay.
Published the Cube in 91.
Mm-hmm.
And the United Airlines magazine ran a small article on it. And my program director at the NIH said, Dad, I want you to write a little something about this. So I went through all sorts of prevarications about how this was just showing things about the flexibility of branched junctions, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, all sorts of horseshit.
Mm-hmm.
And because that was relevant to the NIH, the mission of my NIH grant.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was standing behind, one time I was standing behind her boss at the biophysics meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying, people ask if we're relevant, and Ned Seaman's stuff, he didn't know I was there, Ned Seaman's stuff is being cited in the United Airlines magazine. And at that point, I realized, as long as people like it, you know, you can maybe get away with a little of it, but not with you can get away with it with the administrators, but you can't get away with it with the study section.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can't even get away with it with the administrators. I mean,
do you have a copy of that still? The American Airlines?
The United Airlines thing? I certainly have the reference to it. I'm not sure if I have the...
Okay, just curious. Interesting to see.
Because in those days, I mean, it was probably in paper.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking of millions of people would see it. I mean, all the people sitting, you know, bored on airlines or flipping through the magazines, they're going to see this thing.
Yeah, lots of people must have seen it.
Yeah.
Well, that's why her boss was so... Yeah.
Did anyone ever write you, just, you know, I was flying from New York to Chicago? Okay.
No, nobody ever did that. The only time I've ever been recognized on the street was the afternoon or the evening that the Kavli was announced.
Yeah.
Some NYU student had seen it on at this science festival thing.
Yeah.
And she said, "Hello, Professor Seaman." I said, "Hi, do I know you?" And she said, "I saw you on this TV thing this morning." It's the one time I've ever been recognized.
Okay.
To the best of my knowledge.
Okay, so you got the NIH, and then you have everything else.
Everything else is the nanotech in one flavor or another.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And, and that's, you know, largely military and a little bit of NSF.
Mm-hmm. So when you apply to NSF, what directorate or division or whatever do you send your proposals go to?
Well, the main NSF division that has supported me is, in fact, computation. Because this is usually a joint grant. It's called collaborative research, so that it's administratively better than me being the PI or Natasha. But it's a grant with Natasha.
Mm-hmm.
So Natasha and I have been getting money from the NSF for, I don't know, we're on about our third or fourth round now.
Okay.
And she takes a small amount of money and supports a student in her summer salary.
Mm-hmm.
And I take a not much greater amount of money, but maybe three times as much. But I mean, like the last round, the round before last round may have been $100,000. The round before that was like 75,000, and the goddamn program director of the time, you know, wanted me to go down to Washington and participate in his goddamn meetings that he was forced to run. $75,000 a year. I mean, be serious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the military wants those every year, but you know, the NSF is kind of moving into that mode.
Okay.
So
to think about it, you know. You've got the lab here. You've got your students, your postdocs, your grad students. What does it cost annually, you know, to keep it all going?
More than right now, I have committed to me, but not necessarily in my pocket, about $1 million to $1.2 million
per year.
This year.
Okay.
I mean, last year I had to spend a lot of time writing stuff because I'm not used to this mode of having a whole bunch of small grants. In fact, I let a bunch of them lapse, and I had to, you know, get them back.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the financial services at this university, which you can quote me on, are incompetently managed. And I've got about $500,000 in so-called account receivables that they're not willing to recognize. You know, in money that's going to come in when the Navy gets its money.
Yeah.
You know, from the continuing resolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Looking at the military agencies, I mean, you've had Navy, Air Force, DARPA. Can you give me just a general sense of what those are like relative to work with?
The Navy and the Army have both been wonderful.
Okay.
DARPA dropped me like... most of these, I'm a subcontractor. I'm not the...
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever been the prime contractor on anything except that first round of Navy funding.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of went on 15 years and then it stopped. And I was a prime contractor once on a small, like, four-person grant.
Okay.
But I'm... The Navy's and the Army, you know, it's always an issue of, gee, you know, do we have... We'll try to get you the money as soon as we can, but it might not be there right away, and you just have to learn to live with that, which NYU doesn't seem capable of doing. DARPA gave me... 6 months later, gave me a huge amount of money, and the third time for 2 years, and so the money was 6 months late, and then the third year, they dropped me like a hot potato, and I'm still suffering from the effects of that.
Hmm.
10 years later, they sent the money to Iraq. So I haven't gone back to DARPA. Maybe I should.
I've heard other people say this about DARPA, which I find interesting. You know, if you just pick up a magazine, you know, DARPA's always portrayed as this, you know, really lean, forward. Agile, forward-thinking. When I talk to some scientists who get DARPA money...
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, DARPA's idea is we want to produce a baby in a month. Let's get 9 women pregnant. That's the essence of a DARPA proposal.
Okay.
We're going to impregnate 9 women and you'll get your baby in a month. You know, but that's much closer to development than it is to research.
Yeah.
I mean,
because I know they had like their 6.1, 6.2 various divisions.
Well, 6.1 is more or less research, and 6.2 is kind of development, and 6.3 is contractors for, you know, supplying munitions and weaponry.
Yeah.
And I don't even know, you know, what those 6.1, 6.2 budgets are or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what I'm funded out of. I assume it's 6.1.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the end they come through with the money.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard to live on military money at NYU because it's coming in dribs and drabs.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have a proper buffering system in place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where, all right, here's, you know, you're going to get $200,000 this year. We'll just set aside $200,000 for you, and then basically the Navy money will pay you back.
Okay.
You know, they don't do that here.
So they're just waiting for it literally as it comes in the door, then it goes to you.
They wait for it to come in the door, and about 2 months later it gets to me, or about a month later it gets to me, if it comes from the door.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so right now I'm in, I have, you know, $500,000, I mm-hmm. think. It's either $500,000 or $350,000, I mean, I think it's $500,000, in so-called accounts receivable,
mm-hmm.
that they're not giving me credit for right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are various people that I, you know, that I am unfond of as a consequence.
Mm-hmm. You know. Any qualms about military funding?
I had them in the beginning, but basically I don't think we've done anything that's going to... I mean, I don't write proposals to say we're going to develop a nerve gas or whatever. I mean, I write proposals to do what I would do anyway.
Okay.
Which is, you know, relatively innocuous stuff, I think. You know, building better computers... Mm-hmm. Better, smaller, faster computers, lighter computers, mm-hmm. whatever. The military will certainly take advantage of that if we can do it.
Yeah.
So will every other, you know, enterprise and endeavor in, you know, in the civilian economy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, Eric Winfrey doesn't take military money.
That's in part why I asked.
Eric Winfrey's at Caltech.
Okay.
And if I were at Caltech, I could afford to have arguably those principles.
Okay.
But I can't afford the principles, and the military has actually treated me rather well. I make no bones about it. I'm a Vietnam War draft dodger.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go. I was. If you read my biography, yeah. You saw how I, you know, got out of the draft by, mm-hmm. by faking my physical effectively. I mean, you know, they leave it open to me. You know what I'm going to eat. I can eat what I want, and respond appropriately. But in fact, I mean, I gave a lecture one time at West Point,
mm-hmm.
and I was extraordinarily impressed,
mm-hmm.
by the teaching going on there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their undergraduate teaching was in many respects like my graduate teaching. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I treat graduate students as younger members of my profession,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, I teach undergraduates, I treat undergraduates, correctly or otherwise, as, you know, basically, the, you know, a chore.
Mm-hmm.
But to teach, they don't really care about what I'm teaching them. They're taking my courses because they have to, not because it's going to have any impact,
mm-hmm.
On the rest of their lives, except that if they do well, they can, you know, go off and become medical people,
mm-hmm.
Or health people of one flavor or another. None of them, to speak of, really want to go on and become a scientist that, mm-hmm. I'm aware of. You know, and, you know, at Albany, at least they were poor kids who were doing the best they could education-wise. And, you know, yes, they would slit your throat for a point, but it was... you know, I understood it. Here, they're just, I really haven't taught undergraduates in a very long time because they're treated as customers here.
Yeah.
And you cannot teach customers.
Yeah.
And there is an aspect of no pain, no gain to teaching.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were kind of instructed, you know, no pain.
Mm-hmm. So. How about patents?
I've got about 10 or 11 or something.
Is this something that the university actively encourages you to pursue?
Well, the university owns the patents. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, this
At one point, the university went out and peddled my goods they licensed my patents to a company that brought in a fair amount of cash mm-hmm. to my lab.
Okay.
That was part of the patenting deal.
What was the patent for?
Well, it was the set of them. Everything, you know, about DNA nanotech. And then that company went belly up after 3 years, mm-hmm. it was a 5-year contract. And they haven't gone back to trying to do that again. I'm much to my disappointment, because that was real money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was the one dollop I've gotten out of the private sector that was there.
Okay.
I mean, there have been occasionally grants, private grants. I've been funded a couple times, kind of small scale. From the Keck Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, I noticed the sign on your door, I think, as a Keck.
That sign on my door. Actually, I was part of that Keck grant, but this was somebody else. This was Schwartz, actually.
Okay.
I told you Schwartz would start off.
Yeah.
And it wasn't me.
Okay.
I got like half of a useless instrument out of that grant. And then more recently, along with the physicists, we had some money that enabled our most recent Nature paper.
Okay.
About self-reproducing. I don't know if you saw that.
The patents, are you the only, are you the sole person?
No, I mean, if there's students involved, I put the students on there.
Okay.
And some of the patents are with Jim Canary, because it's, you know.
You mentioned him before. Where is he based?
He's on the third floor.
Okay.
He's an organic chemist, and mm-hmm. we've worked together for 15 years now.
Okay.
And we share a couple of grants, and, you know, whatever.
Okay. Tell me about the Kavli Prize. I mean, the picture that is sitting here behind me with you at the Oval Office with Obama and Eigler wearing, I think, what might be Eigler's best suit.
And mine.
Yeah. Okay.
My only suit.
Yeah. So, just, you know, how'd that all happen?
The prize?
Yeah. How'd you find out? They call you?
Oh, it's a funny story, actually.
Yeah.
In April of 2010, a Norwegian topologist by the name of Nils Boss gets in touch with me.
Mm-hmm.
He's been in the news over the last couple of years because he's come up with sort of hyperstructures of one sort or another. So, like Borromean rings of Borromean rings. This may not mean much to you, but
no, it doesn't.
Borromean rings are three. You know you've probably never heard of the Borromeo family in Milano.
No.
Okay. So there were three branches of the family,
mm-hmm.
and they had a series of rings. Or also, Ballantine ale had the same symbol.
Okay.
Three rings, but if you look closely at them, they're linked. They're linked together. Such that if you break one, the other two fall apart. So the idea was that if one branch of the family falls apart, the rest of us fall, you know, go away. So he's made like Borromean rings of Borromean rings, and he was on sabbatical, and he tried to actually talk to some other chemist who has done topological stuff, and the guy didn't get back to him, so he sent an email to me, and I'm pretty responsive in that regard. And he said, so he comes up. And we spend the afternoon together. I forget whether we ate lunch or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we decided we would. In fact, we have a paper that's now sort of in press and print. I don't know where it is right now. About, you know, how some of these things might be synthesized chemically. And in fact, one of my, that's a project I'm going to give one of the newer students I'm planning to take.
Okay.
So, you know, we said, you know, we'll write papers, we'll try to write grants, see if there's some sort of, you know, joint Norwegian money. So his name was Nils Boss. And then he goes back to Princeton, and he's, I don't hear from him again. And, you know, he's on sabbatical, and I figure, you know, at some point he's going back to Norway, you know, I'll hear from him when I hear from him. You know, a lot of these things I said, you know, that sometimes they work out, sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
This one actually, in the end, this one did work out. But at least partially. And then on June, I think, the night of June the 2nd, I'm here till 2 a.m. working, which is not uncommon for me. Mm-hmm. That was a little later than normal. Mm-hmm. And I go to bed. But normally I'm here till about midnight, but you know, sometimes you just got to put a push on. You're never going to get something done. Mm-hmm. And it's harder now, but ever since you know the Obama event wound up with my injuring my back, so I take too many drugs now. But at any rate, I'm in bed. I'm asleep. It's 5:30 in the morning, and the phone rings, and I'm not a morning person anyway. I'm totally incoherent, and I answer the phone, and I can only make out two words: Nils and Norway. I say, Nils, Norway. Oh, Nils, how are you? How are you? How are you doing? And he says, I don't know who you think you're talking to. This is Nils, somebody else. I'm the head of the Norwegian Academy of Arts and Letters, and I'm calling to tell you, mm-hmm. etc. And he called me at that time of the morning because around the corner from me was some New York Science Festival where Kavli was and where some Nobel laureates were and whatnot. And I was supposed to go over there, and there was going to be a transmission to the Science Festival, and I was supposed to stand up and wave at the appropriate moment when, as the Norwegians announced the prize. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as chance would have it, I had sent off, or maybe I hadn't yet sent off, my laundry to be done. I had no socks, a t-shirt, but I had I wandered in there wearing a pair of sandals, a t-shirt. I had enough sense to put on a blazer or something, and I'm totally dazed because it's like I've had 3.5 hours sleep that night before, and I sit down. So other NYU people knew about this, the provost knew about it, the PR guy knew about it, and so forth. I was instructed to call him, and they said, "Yeah, go around the corner to the science festival," which I otherwise wouldn't have been going to at all, and. Try to wave and try not to drool or fall asleep during the ceremonies. So I did all this, and there are photo ops and comedy. And then I get all the instructions. You have to have this black suit for the ceremonies, and then you'll have to rent a tux in. If you don't own a tux, you have to rent a tux in Oslo. Mm-hmm. And it turned out about a week or two later, I was supposed to be going to Hong Kong anyway for a meeting, so I got my black suit in Hong Kong.
Okay.
Because it was, I was there, and that's where you can buy suits relatively cheap.
Yeah, that's true.
So I did that. Uh-huh. And I did the right thing. I mean, they had the ceremonies. We were so tightly scheduled in Oslo. I mean, we sat down with the people there, and it was, at 9 o'clock, here we are at, 10 a.m, all right? At 3 this afternoon, you're going to be here, and you're going to be wearing this. Mm-hmm. At 5 this afternoon, you're going to be here, and you're going to be wearing that. Mm-hmm. And you were just totally scheduled in terms of dress and whatever. And at some point, we were supposed to be in some symposium, and Don and I had to sneak out to get our tuxes measured.
This is you and Don Ogler.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Because there was just no room on the schedule to get our tuxes measured. Mm-hmm.
Did you two know each other before?
We had met once. I didn't really... By chance, we both wound up at a Gordon conference about a month later.
Okay.
And I had seen his picture. He recognized me. I didn't actually recognize him because his pictures are a little younger than he is. And I didn't really recognize the pictures I had seen were taken 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I didn't quite recognize him. I mean, while I was talking to him, I realized, oh shit, this is Don. Mm-hmm. we only met once at a CFAR meeting. It's Canadian something something something. The R is research.
Okay.
CIFA, whatever that stands for. You know, advanced research for advanced research. Somehow he has a connection with him. And All I knew was that he was in the room. I might have heard him say something. I don't think we chatted really. Mm-hmm. We probably heard each other's talks.
Yeah.
But I often forget what people look like. And
so okay.
So I didn't know. But anyway, we chatted a bit at the Gordon Conference in New Hampshire, wherever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then we re-encountered each other up in Oslo.
Okay.
But I didn't really know, because we do really quite different things.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what they were doing was they were simply trying to get, get rid of a sort of backlog of people who were owed,
mm-hmm.
Who had been leaders in nanotech,
mm-hmm.
For a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all right, so, because there were two people the time before, Lou Bruce and the guy, and some Japanese guy who discovered carbon nanotubes.
Oh, Ajima, Sumio Ajima.
Yeah, Ajima, all right. And, arguably Ajima could have gone to Stockholm with Rick Smalley and Proto and whatever, but he didn't.
Yeah.
And so this was kind of, his recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you get to meet? You met Copley then.
Oh yeah, I met Copley here. That morning.
Yeah. So what did you think?
Well, I mean, we didn't really talk.
Yeah.
Then okay. I mean, it's always he's always very nice, very cordial.
Okay.
I said, thank you very much, and he said, well, thank you for doing your science or whatever. I mean, he's a very nice guy. How are we doing? Okay.
So who do you see? I was curious. I mean, the next prize will be announced, in 2012.
Yeah.
What's your sense of
I have still not. For me, it was kind of weird because I disappeared for that, and I disappeared for my sabbatical. I'm only just coming back now.
Yeah.
So I'm not re-entered. Were I re-entered, I would have had the time to do the nominations of Paul and Bernie,
mm-hmm.
for who I think deserve that prize.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to give a prize to DNA Nanotech. I don't think there's anybody else who deserves a DNA Nanotech prize at this time.
Mm-hmm.
If there are other forms of recognition, somewhere along the line, I expect Eric will get some kind of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
But for DNA Nanotech, that's his contributions haven't really been significant except through his students or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you could say that Eric, to some extent, contributed to Paul's work, because Paul was technically working for Eric, but Eric's name's not on the paper, so
mm-hmm.
I don't know what the bottom line story is there.
Mm-hmm.
If Eric wants wants his prizes, he has to put his name on his papers.
Okay.
Okay.
Fair enough.
My name goes on all my students' papers.
Yeah.
And, Alex Rich's name goes on all of his people's papers,
mm-hmm.
and that's the way the game is played in this business.
Mm-hmm.
Hopfield's name was not on the paper that Eric and I and my people did,
mm-hmm.
so there may be a different tradition there and in that area,
mm-hmm.
but that's part of recognition.
So we're about out of time, and I don't want to impinge on your getting ready for teaching your class, but is there anything... we can always come back to this.
Yeah.
I mean, I come to New York a fair amount of things we haven't taught, that we haven't touched on.
What are we missing?
Well, that's what I'm going to ask you. I mean, is there something over the things we've talked about the last couple of days, or you're sort of wondering, why isn't he asking about, X or Y?
No, I think it's been pretty thorough in terms of what we've talked about. It's the nature of my, being at a place like this, that not too many of my people are going to wind up being PIs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's kind of inevitable. If they go to a really super postdoc,
mm-hmm.
then I think they can become PIs. So Chengde Mao was with George Whitesides at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Howe did very well with John Reif,
mm-hmm.
And he was kind of recognized. That it was really him, not Reif, doing much of it. I think Reif may have contributed more than is obvious, but
mm-hmm.
I think he, you know, it's not clear there. But Howe certainly got them off the ground experimentally. They didn't know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I mentioned, the guy who built the assembly line, he's at Yale. He missed getting one of these Wellcome grants, but he was a finalist. So he's obviously going to be a player. I expect him to be a PI sometime, somewhere. Can't always, you know, you can't, I mean, Eric's people jumped to Harvard, right? I mean, he's got this guy, Peng Yin, who just went to Harvard. He's, seems to me okay, but I don't know if he's walks on water good or not.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see.
What do you do when you're not here?
When's that?
Okay.
I mean, I travel so much.
Yeah. I mean, I know you're, you said you're leaving for another trip tomorrow, so.
Yeah, that's right. I travel so much that you know, when I'm here, I'm here.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I
guess I meant like, you know, hobbies. I'm assuming you don't have kids. So.
I don't have kids. My longtime girlfriend and I just got married because of some fuck up with his Social Security. So I mean, otherwise we would just, you know, we wouldn't have bothered with it. I mean, she was losing.
Well, congratulations.
I mean, it was in May. I mean, it's not a big deal. Uh-huh. I mean, it was just a technical thing. Yeah. Together since we,
you two met here in New York, right?
Yeah, we met.
Yeah.
So I eat dinner with her every night.
She's a scientist, or
no? Okay. No. She writes grants for nonprofits.
Oh, okay.
And her business is basically dried up.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Bloomberg does not believe in there being money for poor people. So there are no RFPs. I mean, she writes the grants for people who are competing for RFPs for, you know, to help poor people. But there are no RFPs to help poor people in New York anymore.
Yeah.
She has an extraordinary batting average, and I mean, I wish I had such a batting average with my science grants.
Did she ever read any of your grant applications?
No, she can't. One time we tried it. I have a close friend who came to the U.S. at around in his late 40s, early 50s, from Russia, and he wasn't very good at English at the time, and he said, "Well, maybe Nora could look at, you know, read my grant." It wound up, I had to do what he wanted her to do because she didn't know the words.
Okay.
And, you know, topoisomerase, is that a verb or a noun or a, you know, an adjective?
Yeah.
She just had no clue.
Okay.
So she's not at all scientifically inclined.
Does she travel with you?
She travels with me often.
Okay.
You know, when we go to San Francisco, always, she'd rather live there than here. She's a native of there.
Okay.
She actually hates New York now, and that's life. I'm immovable at this point. I'm simply too old to move up the food chain, and I'm not about to make a lateral move at this point in my life.
Okay.
I mean, I can't afford to lose a year or two in the infrastructure that I've built up here. She's kind of reconciled herself to that. But she's not happy. So yes, she travels with me whenever we can. So if I get an invitation to go to some dump, she may or may not want to come with me. But like I got an invitation to go to Bangalore. She's an Indiophile, so that's where we're going next week.
Okay.
So we'll be in India for about 3 weeks. India, Sri Lanka, and then I have to go to Qatar, and so she'll go with me to Qatar.
I was there last year.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
How is Qatar?
Bizarre.
Yeah.
I was there to give a
bizarre with an I.
Yeah. Yeah. Not a soup, bizarre. I was there to give a couple talks at the Northwestern campus.
Yeah.
And I went with my partner, and, you know, it was fantastic. Yeah. I mean, we were well taken care of for the whole week and everything, but it's just a weird place.
Yeah, I'm expecting it to be weird. I mean, it's 3 days, 4 days, something yeah. like that, you know.
You know, if you get a chance, the Islamic Art Museum is incredible.
Okay, Islamic art is like my favorite kind of art, so, you know, I mean,
yeah.
it's all this geometrical stuff. Right?
Yeah, that's interesting, yeah. I mean, that's pretty mind-blowing, and just the skyline itself is just this weird, futuristic hodgepodge of whatever. But, anyways, you'll have a good time. Well, we should probably wrap it up so you can get ready for class.
Okay,
great. Let me just pause this here. Okay, stop it. That's stopped.